This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. It's an exciting time for Toastmasters as we're in the midst of the organization's centennial celebration. And we're celebrating here at the Toastmasters podcast by having not one, but two episodes to commemorate this festive time. And we have a special guest today. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce Daniel Rex, Toastmasters International's Chief Executive Officer. A significant part of his role is to support the Toastmasters of today by leading the Toastmasters World Headquarters team and providing service, resources, and support to our members and Toastmasters clubs worldwide. He also works very closely with the International President and the Board of Directors to envision the Toastmasters of tomorrow. Today, they develop the plans and strategies that enable us to fulfill our mission and reach our envisioned future. Daniel knows Toastmasters better than most. He attended his first club meeting back in 1989 and has been a leader in the World Headquarters team and has worked with our board of directors and district leaders since 1990, giving him a unique perspective and extensive depth of knowledge. Since 2008, when he took on his current responsibilities, he has provided a steady hand while the organization has gone through massive transformation and has emerged as a stronger, more cohesive global organization. Chief Executive Officer Daniel Rex, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Greg, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I'm happy to be with you today to chat on this topic and share some of my experiences and perspective. And thank you for all you do for Toastmasters and for conducting this podcast on a regular basis and for the wonderful information that you've been able to collect and spread throughout the Toastmasters ecosystem and the world.
Thank you, Dan. It's been an honor and a pleasure as well. Now, we're here to talk about Toastmasters 100, but before we get to that, so some of us can get to know you a little better, take us back 35 years to 1989. It's your first club meeting. Tell us a little about that experience and what motivated you to embark on this journey to bring you to where you are today.
Oh my, 1989, I was a graduate student working on my MBA, and one of the opportunities on the campus where I was attending was a Toastmasters club, and I had no idea what it was. But it happened to be at an evening and at a time when I could visit. So I went and I attended my first club meeting, and there were speeches and table topics, and someone conducted the meeting, and there was an enormous amount of applause going on. And all of that sounds familiar to those of us who have spent time going to club meetings. And I thought, well, this is very interesting. And I remember signing up and paying my dues and joining, but it was near the end of the semester, and I'm not sure I made it to more than a couple of meetings. And then I got a job and left school, went to a different state, and kind of moved on. That first experience was certainly formative and helped me build from a very basic level my understanding of what Toastmasters was.
Let's go a little further back. Now, I know you weren't around 100 years ago, but in 1924, Dr. Ralph C. Smedley had a vision for this organization. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on his vision?
Now, one of the first assignments that I had when I started working at Toastmasters headquarters was to do a review of the story of Toastmasters, the original version that he wrote. I remember my boss giving me these galleys to proofread. And I sat down and I read through it and I thought, you've got to be kidding me. This is how this all began. But his vision, as we look back 100 years later, his vision was crystal clear in terms of what he wanted to do and how he wanted to accomplish it and the need that he saw. Individuals who needed to improve their communication skills, he knew how to help them improve their communication skills, though by his own admission, he was not a master communicator nor a master speaker, but apparently a pretty darn good evaluator. Those early meetings that happened in several locations have eventually become what we know now to be Toastmasters. That's an amazing thing, an incredible gift that he gave to the world.
Absolutely. 1924, 2024, 100 years. How do you think the organization has changed since he started it? And at the same token, how has it stayed the same?
You know, if we step away from scale and just the breadth of the organization and go directly to the club meeting, which is the core and the most important part of our Toastmasters world, and in my perspective, I don't think the meeting has changed much. Are we more formal or less formal? I don't know. Certainly it was all men in the beginning, and we're very much not all men now. In my eyes, that's a great change for the better. But someone leads the meeting. Others give prepared speeches. There is, as Smedley would call it, criticism of the speeches that we call evaluation now. Impromptu speaking questions. Someone is timing, a grammarian, an accenter. Those things, as far as we know and understand, were part of the early original meetings, and they still exist today. That's incredible to me. And that tells me that he understood what was needed and how to go about it, and that our tradition and our structure has carried it on. But getting back to scale, he couldn't imagine, and in some of his writings, he talked about scope and the breadth of the organization, and couldn't imagine, for example, there being 500 clubs. Well, we've had thousands and thousands of clubs that have come and gone, and you know, more than 13,000 that exist now, and we peaked out at well over 16,000. So I don't think in his world of the 1920s through the 1960s, when he experienced this, he could have envisioned the sheer size of what Toastmasters has become.
We're going to talk a little bit later about the progression of Toastmasters. Would you say it's fair to say that the organization is still true to Dr. Smedley's vision?
Oh, I'd say absolutely. In many ways, and especially at the club meeting level, we are attempting to be true to Dr. Smedley's vision. And in my view, it's really up to each club. Are we conducting great club meetings? Are we taking this business of fun seriously enough to do it properly? And when we do that, then I think that we're really close to what his vision was and the methods that were part of the process in the beginning.
This sounds like the better practices we try to incorporate into our meetings. That's great.
I'd say absolutely. When we're sticking with the better practices for our meetings and following the program as designed, I think we're right there with where we need to be, both from a modern quality perspective and in alignment with the original vision.
I agree. Sears, Kodak, Radio Shack, these are companies that were around for a long time, but no longer exist. Dan, what do you think Toastmasters has lasted and survived for 100 years, and what need does this organization need to fill?
I was chatting with a reporter some years ago, and we were talking about this topic, and she put an eloquent answer together, much better than I could at the time. And she said, how about the need that goes way back to the earliest we understand of humanity for people just to gather together and speak? Think of early humans around a campfire kind of concept. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I do believe that for most of us and for much of humanity, there is a need to be part of something that is greater than just ourselves and to have the opportunity to be together with others and communicate and discuss a variety of topics and to grow personally through that interaction. And whether it's our skill as an orator, our ability to listen, our ability to learn and expand our thinking, all of those things come together into what this experience is. And it's my belief and my observation as I've traveled the Toastmasters world that this need exists across languages and cultures, and that it's very near and dear to a basic human need.
It's interesting how those basic human needs, those are the same now as they were a century ago. That's amazing.
You know, they are. We like to think that we're, and we are technologically more advanced than humans have been as far as we know, but human nature doesn't change that quickly. And as much as the accoutrements and all the things around us change, the inside of a person is very near to what it was perhaps 10,000 years ago, let alone 100 years ago.
You also mentioned technology. How would you say technology has impacted Toastmasters? And give us a little insight as to what it was like before we had the internet and email at World Headquarters.
Yeah, it's fascinating because if you think about a club meeting, the impact of technology has been peripheral. Is there a microphone? Are there speakers? Is this being recorded, the audio being recorded? Is there a video recording? Is there playback to evaluate at a later time? All of those things are potentially there, as well as presentation add-ons. You know, we've gone from using paper visuals or cardboard visuals to using electronic visuals. And all of those are connected to the experience of being a speaker or listening to people speak, but they're not the core of it. So I view that the technology around speaking is secondary to the speaking itself. Organizationally, though, we've changed dramatically. You know, we've been interestingly a bit technology averse. There were times when, you know, having a club meeting by video or distant audio would have been taboo. And that's no longer taboo. When we look at the way that our office at World Headquarters interacts with clubs and individual members around the world, that has changed dramatically. There used to be enormous amounts of postal mail that would come. The paper was endless. The processing of paper and paper financial transactions, checks, and so forth was incredibly time-consuming and expensive. And now all of that, of course, happens through the internet. So the number of transactions has increased over time, but 90% of our transactions are fully done by members online, and the headquarters team doesn't need to intervene or really even touch most of those transactions, where I remember the days when it was all paper, and that certainly wasn't efficient.
I remember past international director Danny Hardy telling us about the big stacks of paper that he used to get in the mail.
Yeah. You know, now you go to the website and there's a dashboard with different reports on it, but, you know, different people serving in different roles of the organization would get weekly mail or monthly mail about their role and updates or schedules for the future about different meetings and things by paper mail. And, you know, in those days when we were primarily a North American organization, that seemed reasonable. In today's world, that doesn't seem reasonable at all.
Yeah, that's true. You mentioned you were national. Now, of course, it's international, so the technology can certainly help that because you can communicate around the world in a matter of milliseconds.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. I remember years ago, of course, pre-internet days, having correspondence with people forming clubs in parts of the world that were distant to us. And it would take a couple of weeks for a piece of mail to reach them, some time for them to respond, a couple of weeks for it to return. It was all very, very delayed. I'm telling you how old I am and how long I've been with the organization. And now, of course, it's instantaneous. And, you know, my phone and my email and my messaging all blows up 24/7. And that's just part of today's world, the instantaneousness of that sort of communication and the process. And, you know, it's made it dramatically easier for us to communicate with clubs and members around the world. It's really a boon for us organizationally.
Of course, when it works, right?
Yeah, when it works.
Because folks, we had a few challenges on our setup today with audio, but
yeah,
we are here and we're good to go. And it was great how quickly Toastmasters adopted the Zoom technology to be able to have meetings basically restarting. And not only that, is having members being able to visit not only their local club virtually, but clubs all around the world.
Yeah, the beginning days of the COVID-19 pandemic were a little terrifying for the organization. What would happen? Would clubs and individual members adopt online video models and different pieces of software in different parts of the world that would enable them to continue to conduct their meetings? And it was a very quick adoption in some places, a little slower in others. And being global, we were able to observe and see as first clubs in different parts of the world were adopting and some of the things they went through and stumbled through and their successes and ways they needed to improve, so that by the time it got around the world, there was some organizational knowledge and some developing expertise on how to do this and how to do it successfully.
Toastmasters International started in the United States, but it's an international organization now. Can you talk a little bit about the progression of the growth in Toastmasters?
Yeah, happy to. Of course, the first club that started that continued was in Southern California in the city of Santa Ana. 100 years ago now. Quickly, there were other clubs, and quickly, within a couple of years, throughout Southern California and other places, there started to be clubs further north within the state, clubs in Arizona, and then quickly into Canada, on the west coast of Canada, in Victoria, I think it was.
Yes.
And a lot of Canadian pride from that I've experienced over the years, and I think that's a great thing. You know, it's the club that made Toastmasters International, and I think that's fantastic. After Canada, a slow but steady spread through England, Scotland, and some of the other countries that were primarily English-speaking. These were in the years toward the end of World War II, so some former British Empire countries, as well as other countries that were suddenly experiencing the need to speak English. And there was some spread that went through the military. There were military bases in various parts of Asia that had clubs that were sprouting on base and that eventually went out into the community and into the local populace. A non-deliberate way of global proliferation, but a steady way in those early decades.
That's awesome. I enjoyed my time as public relations manager, although we always know that public relations is everyone's responsibility. I noticed, particularly in looking at some of the references and documentation, that there was a huge impact on growth between the 1960s and the 1980s. And I'm wondering if you can share a little insight into that.
Yeah, there were a couple of fortuitous things that happened. One of them was some really, from the Toastmasters perspective, strong public relations messages. There were some articles and concepts that got picked up by major publications. A Reader's Digest article in 1960. Reader's Digest at that time was spreading around the world and as an English language publication and ultimately translated into a lot of languages. And Toastmasters was fortunate to be highlighted in a month of Reader's Digest and brought a lot of scrutiny. We're in Life magazine with a big article at one point and others. And these were in the years when the Toastmasters brand was not well known. When you said Toastmasters, people often didn't know what it was, certainly in other parts of the world. And there was also an appetite for American organizations and for English language organizations. And if you got to go somewhere and practice English, that was also helpful and be part of something that was, you know, different than what was happening in your home location. Public relations also sparked enormous growth in the U.S. and Canada. And the growth of clubs in the 1960s through the 1980s was tremendous. A significant part of that was organizations that were beginning to sponsor Toastmasters clubs in-house. So there were government organizations in different cities, provinces, or states and countries, as well as corporations that recognized the value that Toastmasters was bringing from a learning standpoint and a collaboration and collegiality standpoint.
Now, if you look at the stats, it's interesting. You talked earlier about Canada and England and Scotland. But it seems that if you go back maybe for the last 20 years, there's been an incredible growth in Asia, particularly I think in India and China, but also in the Middle East. Dan, could you share a little insight about the growth in that area and why is it Toastmasters International is so appealing in that part of the world?
An intriguing question. Toastmasters, again, as we talked about a few minutes ago, this need that humans have or want that humans have to be together and to communicate and be part of something. As communication barriers came down with the introduction of the World Wide Web and the introduction of email, these types of opportunities for Toastmasters became more available and the roadblocks to them were knocked down really very quickly. Our growth in Asia, there were a few countries. We had clubs in Japan and clubs on the island of Taiwan and in Malaysia and Singapore and Hong Kong, but they were quite small. When there began to be communication and easy communication between all of these groups, growth started to take off. And the barriers of communication, as well as the barriers of logistics and providing materials and expertise, began to come down. And the appetite is driven, I believe, by a desire for self-improvement that is happening culturally within the geography at the time, whether it's a city or a, you know, a city-state like Singapore or in a country like Malaysia. We had enormous growth in Malaysia through the 1990s, and it was really a beautiful thing to watch. Later, it spread into China as well as the Gulf countries in the Middle East. And it was primarily happening through people who had been a member of a club somewhere, and then they transferred for work or for personal reasons, moved to another country and said, I think we need Toastmasters here. And then, the reason why it catches fire, in my view, is a cultural drive towards self-improvement coupled with an opportunity to have their voices be heard, perhaps in a way that they've not experienced before, and to serve in leadership positions. And they may not have had leadership opportunities in their community or in their work before.
Wow. It's amazing because now you find all around the world, of course, many English-speaking clubs. You'll find local language-speaking clubs, but you'll also find bilingual clubs, which is incredible.
Yeah, I was in Japan once attending a club meeting, and the first 30 minutes was all in Japanese, and the second 30 minutes was all in English, and my Japanese is very limited. But it was amazing to watch it and to recognize the core elements of the program and go, oh, that's the evaluation. Okay, that's table topics, and to understand it and the ease and fluidity with which those who were leading the club jumped from language from English to Japanese and back and forth and, you know, blended it together. It was really a beautiful thing to watch.
You know, it's funny. I'm thinking that something that perhaps Dr. Smedley could not have foreseen is this incredible diversity of our membership. In fact, it was 51 years ago, 1973. In fact, that was the year of the first cell phone call. 51 years ago, the clubs enabled women to join Toastmasters. Can you talk a little bit about the diversity of our membership and how does that make for a stronger organization?
Diversity, I think, sometimes is misunderstood in the way that people approach it. We have incredible geographic diversity in Toastmasters. And even if we think about North America, we're everywhere in North America, nearly everywhere in North America. Expand that throughout the world. And you can get off a plane in almost any major city on the planet and think, I want to go to a Toastmasters meeting, and go. There's that sheer broadness. And what that broadness brings is differing experiences. People will have different cultural experiences and family experiences and educational experience and exposure to different types of thought experiences. And as all of that comes together in this big community, there is a sharing of perspectives and methods and ideas relating to communication and leadership that have helped the organization become strong. Now, if you go within those geographic differences, there are all kinds of different people from different places, and there is age diversity, and there is cultural diversity, and there's language diversity, and there's educational diversity, and all these other perspectives. My view and my experience and observation is that all of this diversity makes all of us better. And when we're in a mode when we are opening our minds and looking to learn every day, then we certainly learn from the very diverse group of Toastmasters that are around us and bring their unique experiences to the community.
Dan, I'd appreciate if you could tell us a little bit about the formalization of Toastmasters over time and how has that affected learning and perhaps the Toastmasters educational program?
Sure. When organizations get larger, they tend to invent systems to support them. When Toastmasters was small in the very beginning, there was very little written about how a Toastmasters meeting could be or should be conducted, or how someone could or should prepare a speech, and how someone else was going to evaluate the speech, how the timer worked. Most of that was cultural knowledge that was shared among members. And over time, they began to write it down. And over time, Smedley began to publish a series of articles and essays and little bit leaning toward rules. What they were looking for was consistency of experience in clubs. And he wrote about being bothered by some of the lack of consistency. He wanted someone who walked into a Toastmasters meeting to have a good experience and to experience the skill building and confidence building process. So along about the 1940s, it became clear that the organization was getting quite large and that the written materials needed to expand. And Smedley wrote the first, what we would recognize today as a speech manual called Basic Training. And he was reluctant to do that. He was more of a believer in minimal information and minimal structure. But it also gave the opportunity to the organization to begin to measure. So as people completed projects in the speech manual, when they completed all 15 of them, they'd send in their application for a certificate. Then the organization began to kind of understand what the depth of participation was in terms of speech giving, in addition to the other meeting roles. Well, over time, that evolved, became more broad. There was what became the Basic Communication and Leadership Manual. I think that was in the 1970s, and then Advanced Manual, specializing in other topics. When the digital age arrived and landed on us, organizationally, we knew that we needed to begin to distribute some of our materials digitally. And customers were telling us that. Organizations that charter clubs would kind of look at this stack of manuals and say, what's this about? We want to be able to receive all of this electronically. And at the same time, the cost of logistics and shipping things around the world was becoming very, very expensive. And it became clear that printed materials were the way of the past more than the way of the future. We also knew at the same time that we wanted to evolve the way that the educational material was compiled and presented. And when I say we there, I mean the board of directors recognized this as part of a strategic planning process. So we evolved educational content at the same time that we digitized and began to distribute content electronically to clubs and individual members around the world. And that was a giant step and a very difficult one and painful for some people who had grown up in Toastmasters using paper manuals and become very accustomed to that. And I was one of, you know, I earned my CTM award a long time ago using my paper manual that I still have. And it's been an adjustment for me to do this electronically, but I recognize the efficiency of doing it electronically.
Sometimes I love to have paper in my hand, but I also realize the speed at which you, for example, when changes come to a manual or changes come to a project, to have to go through the printing and the cost and the time for you to get it. So it really makes sense. Yeah, it does.
It's enormous. And when I think back to the COVID-19 pandemic, if we hadn't been ready to distribute materials electronically, and we're still relying on physical shipments around the world, that would not have been a good thing for us.
Just think if Pathways came out 2 years later.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
There's lots of famous quotes by Dr. Ralph Smedley. One of my favorite ones is that we learn best in moments of enjoyment. But I recently came across one where Dr. Smedley said that having the ability to speak is one of the marks of a great leader. And that being able to express yourself in speech is one of the best ways to discover and develop hidden talents. Dan, could you perhaps touch on this insight, and how and why is it still so important to develop speaking skills?
This is another one of those areas where Smedley understood things that today might seem obvious, but I'm not sure how he understood it so deeply at the time. And the understanding that to be a great leader, you must be a very good communicator. Now, you can be a very good communicator and not lead. You can have a great stage presentation and give a speech and not be a leader at all. But on the flip side, for the most part, you can't be a great leader without being a very good communicator. Now, the accoutrements and the things surrounding communications have changed. We're on a podcast right now. There are all kinds of different modes of communication, and some of these are very rapid compared to what we're used to. The days of someone being judged a great communicator because they did a wonderful one-hour stage keynote, I think those are declining. But the ability to express yourself quickly and properly and adequately within whatever environment you exist, I think is important. As humans, we follow vision and we follow communication. think that's a natural part of humanity. How we choose to listen to that communication or find those messages, that can evolve.
So you've touched upon some of the talents and leadership qualities that can be uncovered when you learn to speak well. How does improving your speaking skills increase your confidence?
Now, that's a very tricky question, because I think that communication skills, speaking skills, are wrapped around confidence, especially culturally. Many of us are afraid in the beginning to stand in front of a group and speak, and that might be just five people. Well, once we are okay in front of five, maybe we'll be okay in front of 20. And once we're okay in 20, is it 100? The practice, the repetition that goes into this enables us to set aside fear. People ask me all the time, are you still afraid when you give a speech? And I say, well, I don't know that I'm afraid, but do I have a little bit of anxiety and apprehension? Absolutely. And I think that's good, because it causes me to prepare, to be ready for my message, to be ready for the audience that I'm speaking to. And if I'm ready with my message and if I'm ready for the audience, then my confidence goes up.
For me, it's sometimes, because I'm getting much older, it's more of a question of remembering, no matter how well prepared you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we all have to develop our own techniques for dealing with that, right? Are we using some sort of a visual that's going to cue us? Do we have a couple of sheets of paper on the lectern? What is it that we're doing? Some sort of repetition. But let's not talk too much about getting old, Greg.
So for our last question for part one of this two-part episode, Dan, I'm going to put you on the spot, because back in 2019, I remember you saying to me, well, I re-listened to the podcast to remind myself.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy.
You said to me, communication is the majority of my job.
Yes.
My question is, what did you mean by that? And can you share an example on how you've changed over your years as a communicator?
Yeah. I don't know if I told you the story at the time, so I'll tell you now. There was a time when my daughter, who was in high school at the time, came to me and said, Dad, what do you actually do at work? And I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't really thought about this. And of course, I have a job description. There are policies that direct the things that I do, but how do I accomplish that work? And it took me a while to figure it out and to think about it. But generally, what I do is have conversations and make decisions. Communication being a huge part, nearly all of my job, that's true. I communicate with people one-on-one, in smaller groups, in larger groups. I do interviews like this. Communication is a huge part of my job. And I don't think that, from my perspective, that there's ever enough communication. And I have received criticism, because Toastmasters are really good at providing criticism and feedback. You know, you need to communicate more. Okay, I'm going to communicate more. But at what point is it enough? I don't think it's ever enough. There's always going to be an audience or a segment of your audience that says you need to communicate more. But in a managerial and leadership role like I have, communication and conversation is definitely the majority of the job. It's probably 75% of the job.
And folks, for those of you who didn't hear our previous conversation with Dan, I will include a link in the show notes. So that wraps it up for episode one. Stay tuned for part two of the special Toastmasters 100 podcast. And we'll continue our conversation with Chief Executive Officer Daniel Rex. And on the second episode, he'll enlighten us about the centennial commemorations and how World Headquarters has compiled a variety of ways that you can learn more about the history of Toastmasters and both explore and share in the celebration of Toastmasters' past 100 years. And while you're waiting, folks, remember to share this episode with your friends and family and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and everywhere you get your podcasts. Daniel Rex, Chief Executive Officer, Toastmasters International. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, and I'm looking forward to our conversation in part two of Toastmasters 100 Years.
Thank you, Greg. Always great to be with you and to have a conversation about Toastmasters and provide my perspectives and experience.
Ever imagined a book written just for you? Introducing Pooks.ai. We're not just another bookstore. We're the future of reading. Our state-of-the-art AI adapts each book to your specific needs, creating a personalized masterpiece. Visit Pooks.ai now, that's P-O-O-K-S.ai, and use the promotion code SPOTIFY for a whopping 50% off. Pooks.ai, your personalized book awaits.